From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And today, it's time for a little adventure.
This cave, as you see, is very far from civilization. So probably it's a place where the Boike or Taino shaman came to do what is called Cohoba ritual.
We'll take you caving in the Puerto Rican jungle. And then...
They don't care about Pancho Villa, it's Chapo Guzman. You could like it or not, but that is a part, a slice of reality.
Deep into the glamour and glorified violence of narco-cultura. And my first adventure, running in an official race, and Thanksgiving adventures in the cocina. And more coming up on Latino USA. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And take a listen to this. ¡Fíjala! Combinan caballos con trocas del año, escuadra y escudo con cuerno y pecho. Which is a narco corrido. The band you're hearing is Bucanas de Culiacán, one of the most popular groups of El Movimiento Alterado, or the Altered Movement, which is a new wave of narco corridos. A type of music that tells stories of the violence and anti-heroes of the Mexican cartels. Narco corrido lyrics often have graphic descriptions of shootouts with police, murders, even mutilation. The singer you're listening to is Edgar Quintero, who's featured in a new documentary called Narco Cultura, directed by Israeli war photographer and photojournalist Shaul Schwartz, who joins us in our Harlem studios. Shaul, welcome to Latino USA.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And joining us from Los Angeles is Joel Vasquez, who also appears in the documentary Narco Cultura, and who is a narco corrido marketer. Welcome, Joel.
Thank you for having me.
So, Shaul, your film focuses on two storylines, one in Juarez, the other one in Los Angeles. Why did you decide to tell these two different parts of this story, being narcocultura?
One day in 2010, I woke up in Tijuana. I covered two murder scenes, which was kind of average in those days. And I took my car and drove to Riverside, about an hour or so drive. And I met Bucanas, the group that Edgar is part of. And there he was, kind of parading around with a bazooka in his hand, and I heard the whole crowd, con cuerno de chivo en bazooka en la nuca. And I was shocked. I was angry. I knew of this, but it was my first time in the scene.
So, Joel, for people who are maybe unfamiliar, narco corridos, you know, the corridos that tell the story of narcos have actually been around for a while. That part is not new, but
no.
The movimiento alterado, the altered movement, is actually a new phase of narco corridos. So for people who don't know, what is El Movimiento Alterado?
El Movimiento Alterado, or the new style of corridos, some people call them progressive corridos. Basically what it is taking the bloodshed to another level. It's a much more aggressive lyrical arrangement. It's much more graphic than it was in the past. As you said, corridos have been around forever. And as things have gone exponentially more violent, so have the lyrics of these songs. And that's the new trend that we have with Movimiento Alterado.
So, Shaul, we're going to listen to a clip from your film. This is a clip of some young women talking about what they think about narcos in their community.
A mí sí me gustaría ser la novia de un narcotraficante porque es una forma de vida, no es nada malo. Tal vez sí es algo malo, pero es una forma de vida.
Shaul, talk to us about the normalization of narcocultura, narcocorridos, el movimiento alterado, la violencia that is or is not normalized.
I think you can't go to quinceañera without hearing narco corridos in most of Mexico and in some parts of the U.S. let me play a scenario here. Let's take a 12, 11-year-old growing up in Juarez. He sees his mom and dad working in local maquiladoras, making $5, $6, $7 a day. From this ghetto, from this dirt, he sees these kids riding around in their trocas, making money, being put to burial in mausoleums. He hears these songs. He sees that the girl in high school wants to marry a narco trafficker. The society and these kids, if you step into these kids' shoes, you can kind of easily understand why he doesn't want to educate himself to be a maquilador worker at the end of the day. Look, we could spin this around all day and talk about how we're sad about this and dislike it. And, you know, anytime you'll pin me to the wall, I'll tell you that cartels are the cancer of Mexico and to some degree the cancer of the U.S. But I have to say, when you go out to these clubs, 99% of the kids there, the teenagers there, they're not bad kids. They're just out playing narco for the night. This is the way they connect to their heritage today in America.
Ooh, that's like, that's...
They don't care about Pancho Villa. It's Chapo Guzman.
Wow.
And you could like it or not, but that is a part, a slice of reality.
The truth is that there is a cultural connection to this. As a Mexican-American myself, I can tell you that growing up in Los Angeles, we really didn't have anything of our own. And this generation of kids, I see them and they do cling on to these corridos as something of their own. And they can compare it actively to early rap or gangster rap. And they know they're doing so. They do it willingly and they do it actively. They embrace it as their own because we have a severe lack of identity as Mexican Americans here in the U.S.
But this is not, you know, the heritage that I mean, to call this a heritage or a connection to heritage, I think people hearing this are just saying, oh, wait a second. But the both of you are saying whether or not we like it.
It's the truth. It's what's out there.
It's happening.
So what's the takeaway in terms of narco corrido music as a movement? What are we gaining from it culturally?
To be honest with you, the only positive thing is that the music itself is completely of a Mexican heritage, and it's having a deep connection with these young people.
Shall
I agree? But how did we get there is my question. And you have to realize that the society is defeated because of a reality we ignore.
Well, good questions. And your film absolutely leaves us with a lot of questions and a lot of thoughts. So thank you so much for taking the time to make your film, Shaul, and for you, Joel. Thanks so much for being on the hot seat in California.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Joel Vasquez is the former marketing director for Twins Enterprises, a narco corrido music company. And Shaul Schwartz is the director of the new documentary, Narco Cultura. The film opened last week in New York and Miami and opens in theaters across the country December 6th. For a narco corrido playlist, check out our website at latinousa.org. Continuing the conversation about the culture around narcos, music and the style has become more mainstream in Mexico and in the U.S., but the driving force behind narco culture is the drug trafficking business itself. To help us understand the business of Mexican drug cartels, we have with us now Rodrigo Canales. He's a professor at the Yale School of Management, and he joins us from the studios of WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. Welcome, Rodrigo.
Thank you so much, Maria, and I really appreciate the opportunity to speak to your audience.
So why is it important? Why do you want people to change the narrative, change the perspective on how we look at Mexican drug cartels? You want us to understand them, first and foremost, as business organizations and as very successful business organizations. Why?
I think it's critical to understand them that way because it gives us a completely different perspective on the problem and therefore the solutions that can be used to address it. But this is not the typical thing that I study. And as I was kind of just reading about the drug violence, just from the perspective of a random concerned citizen, I started noticing something that really drew my attention. And I started noticing that some of these drug organizations were using very similar strategies to the ones that I find, you know, institutional entrepreneurs and system entrepreneurs trying to use for legitimation, for public relations, for like media campaigns, for sort of institutionalization strategies.
Well, wait. I mean, I'm sure there are people who are going to be saying, wait a second, public relation campaigns on the part of drug cartels?
Exactly. That was my reaction. It's like, wait, this is unusual. This is unexpected. At the end of the day, these are organizations that when they're sort of operating through a particular community, through a particular municipio, through a particular city, it's not like they can just go through it and not ever interact with the people there. And so, you know, there's a local presence that needs to be had in order to operate in that community. And therefore, the savvier organizations have learned to establish relationships with those communities through different ways. And one of those ways is through whatever your branding strategy might be. And some of them have a branding strategy that it is through terror that they establish their relationship with the community, and the community tolerates them just because they're terrified of them, and like the Setas. But there are other organizations that have a brand of like, no, don't worry about us. We're actually here to protect you from the really bad guys. And so you should not only tolerate us, but you should be happy that we're here.
How does a government, a society, change the behavior of a multi-billion dollar drug trade organization or organizations? How do you do that?
These organizations are business organizations. And they understand the cost-benefit analysis extremely well. And so if it becomes clear that all that you're trying to do is limit violence, and you lay out very clear incentives for them to limit their violence, then what you find is that these organizations very quickly start changing their behavior, and they start limiting violence, and they start using at least different types of strategies and different types of violence that are less lethal, for example. And to me, that's the only realistic thing that we can do. As long as we keep our current approach to demand, then the only realistic thing that we can hope to achieve is to change the behavior of the criminal organizations.
But then, Professor, what you're asking us to do is to accept this notion that existe la narcocultura, that narcoculture is a part, an integral part of Mexico today, and that we have to accept that and work within that? And what do you say to people who are like, I'm not prepared to accept that?
I mean, I'm not asking you to believe in a tooth fairy, right? I'm not asking you to believe in something that I can't show you is there. I'm just asking you to go to the communities and notice that the narcocultura is there. It's not, I'm not inventing something. And it's a culture that we have created through our stubborn pursuit of the same policies that have been failing for decades. We have created this phenomenon, and so we are responsible for changing it. And so if you say to me, well, you're asking me to accept that there's a narcocultura, absolutely, I'm asking you to accept it because it's there. And you have to realize that you're helping create it and that it's destroying communities on both sides of the border. It is destroying communities.
Well, thank you so much, Rodrigo, for shedding light on how we need to look at this in a different perspective that could potentially be more helpful and lead to more solutions.
Oh, thank you so much, Mari, for the opportunity to speak to your audience. I truly appreciate it.
Rodrigo Canales is an associate professor at the Yale School of Management. He spoke to us from the studios of WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. Coming up on Latino USA, Aventuras in the Kitchen.
This special recipe has plantain and a little bit of sweet plantain, with some chicharrón, which is the pork rind, and then some garlic too.
The quest for the perfect pabochón. Stay with us on Latino USA. No se vayan. Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And we know you're probably still working through your Thanksgiving leftovers, but we just had to bring you a kitchen adventure, which might make you hungry enough to do the whole thing all over again. When reporter Vaughn Diaz was a little girl celebrating Thanksgiving in Puerto Rico, her abuela ruled the kitchen. Now Vaughn brings us a recipe her abuelita would be proud of.
There you are.
Hola, Tata.
Hola.
How are
you? You look good.
How are you? Thank you.
Yeah.
How are you?
Just fine,
you
dear.
You look good, too. It's Tata, my grandmother, on Skype. So I wanted to talk to you because I'm making Thanksgiving dinner this year, and when I was little, I always used to go to Puerto Rico to your house for Thanksgiving, so I wanted to get your advice on what I should make and how I should prepare the turkey.
For as long as I can remember, my family spent Thanksgiving in Puerto Rico. And the centerpiece of the meal was always a pavo chong.
So I'm making a pavo chong. With mofongo stuffing.
Wow.
That you used to make it sometimes. Do you remember?
Yeah.
When you used to make
pavo chong is a Puerto Rican take on traditional Thanksgiving turkey.
Well, you have to get it ready the day before.
It's marinated overnight in adobo, a mix of garlic, oregano, olive oil, and vinegar, as if it was lechon or roast pig. It's stuffed with mofongo, an amazing concoction of fried plantains, garlic, and chicharrón, or fried pork skins. The last time I had Thanksgiving with Tata was 9 years ago. And I still vividly remember the smells and sounds and sitting on her patio with a full belly.
And what would you put in the adobo?
Well, the adobo has the garlic. See if I can remember. The garlic with the salt.
Tata can't make Thanksgiving dinner anymore. 7 years ago, we found out she has Alzheimer's. Her memory comes and goes, and when it comes to cooking, she's hard-pressed to heat up a can of soup. I regret having wasted the time I had with her, not learning more about how she made magic in the kitchen. Because it was always about more than food for her. Cooking was how she showed love and built community.
Hi! Welcome. Nice to see you again.
I love you!
Now I'm the one who makes Thanksgiving dinner for my friends and family. Tata's 50-year-old copy of her favorite cookbook, Cocina Criolla, is on the counter in front of me. Its pages stained with decades of olive oil and tomato sauce. I'm taking the leap into making her famous pavo chong. To start, I have to find proper chicharrón for the stuffing. Not pork rinds, like the crappy ones you find at the gas station, but real chicharrón volao. Fried crispy on the outside, soft on the inside, perfectly salted with an amazing crunchy texture. I grab my good friend Nestor, who's also Puerto Rican, to get the best chicharrón I've ever had from Cuchifritos on 116th Street in East Harlem.
Buena, deme dos libras de chicharrón para llevar. Sí, para llevar.
Cógete un pedacito.
We had to try some, just to be sure. Next, I buy an enormous turkey, season it with adobo, and let it sit overnight. But the oven in my tiny New York City kitchen won't fit a proper-sized bird. So I put it on an aluminum tray, slide it on a cookie sheet, wrap it in a plastic bag, and take a cab to my friend Chris's house. And we invite a dozen people over.
Hey, ¿cómo está?
Alegre vengo de la montaña.
Entra.
In order to protect my turkey from drying out in the oven, I flip it upside down and swaddle it in a clean cloth soaked in lard. It's a secret from Cocina Criolla, a trick even Martha Stewart uses, although she uses butter. When that's all done, I turn to the mofongo stuffing. And then I get some help mashing the plantains and chopping the chicharrón.
We're here with
Tamara Oyola Santiago.
And
Néstor Pérez Molire.
And we're making
mofongo con chicharrón.
This special recipe has plantain and a little bit of sweet plantain with some chicharrón, which is the pork rind, and then some garlic too. And then I'll be pouring also some olive oil.
After hours of waiting, tortured by intoxicating smells, it's time.
The bird's been in the oven for about 5.5 hours. It looks great. The skin is browned and looks crispy and delicious, and now we're going to pull it out of the oven.
That turkey is really moist. It tastes like regular Thanksgiving turkey,
but better.
My pavochon is even better than I hoped, and so is the stuffing. A testament to Tata's legacy. It would be
right. El pavo está suavecito, está jugoso. Como diría mi mamá, esto está, mira, que después para chuparse los dedos, riquísimo.
Tamara says, it's finger-licking good. I only wish Tata could be here to taste it. For Latino USA, I'm Vaughn Diaz.
To see and hear more of Vaughn Diaz's Cocina Criolla project, visit our website, latinousa.org. Holidays can also be a kind of contact sport. You know, dodging the drama of family telenovelas, duking it out for oven space. I mean, my mom won't even let me bake a pumpkin pie in her oven. So, everyone's favorite adventure, yes, is the culinary one. And we Latinos have a way of making American traditions our very own. We asked you on social media how your families make yours a Latino Thanksgiving, and you had a lot to say. Latino USA's social media diva, Brenda Salinas, is in the studio with me to share some of your responses. Okay, diva Brenda. So how did our listeners respond to the call out of how they make Thanksgiving Latino?
We got some great responses, over 30 on Facebook and Twitter, and I'm going to read you some of the best ones.
Okay.
Marcos Montes says, usually typical turkey, but we've had turkey mole a few times. And of course, being from New Mexico, we've had Christmas enchiladas, red and green.
Oh, I love that. You forget that they're Christmas enchiladas.
And Joel Cruz says, along with turkey and mashed potatoes, this part Puerto Rican family also makes rice and beans and pernil, roasted pork loin. Can't wait.
Mm.
Hector Flores says, we make tamales with pavo. Recognize.
Tamales with pavo. That sounds delicious.
Doesn't that sound good?
Oh, yum.
The one that sounds the best to me, which I would never think of. Marta Martinez says, jalapeños in our stuffing and calabacitas as a side dish go great with our Thanksgiving pavo.
Oh,
jalapeños and stuffing.
Jalapeños and stuffing. I don't think my mom's ever thought of that.
No, isn't that a great idea?
But she's so traditional, she would be like, no, no.
Well, speaking of the traditional, I have one response like that. Fresa Fresca says, my family put the turkey mole away decades ago. We are all a bunch of pochas and pochos.
So they're owning it. I mean, my family does a pretty typical Thanksgiving. Although now that you think of it, almost always we have guacamole to start with, so... And flan for dessert.
Yeah, some people are saying they had flan for dessert. Virginia Cueto says, and we Cubans have arroz, frijoles, and yuca. Maybe a side of yams, para quedar bien, and flan.
So in terms of the food responses, Brenda, did it break down in terms of food by country of origin?
Absolutely. I mean, our survey isn't comprehensive, but Mexicans make tamales, turkey mole, or turkey enchiladas. Puerto Ricans and Dominicans have pernil. Cubans always leave some room for moros y cristianos, which is rice and beans mixed together. And there are tons of lucky people who have carne asada to go with their guajolote, which means turkey, which I didn't know. I thought the only word for turkey was pavo.
Really? You're Mexican?
I didn't know that.
Guajolote.
Guajolote.
Oh my God. That's like...
I don't think we even had turkey before we moved to the U.S. It just wasn't...
It's not a... Yeah, not even for Nochebuena? No?
Ham.
Ham. Okay. So what was your all-time favorite response that you got, Brenda?
So the best response was from someone you know, Patricia Guadalupe, who's a reporter. She can really make a whole story in a tweet. She says, my parents got into a big argument. My mother threw the turkey away and cooked rice and beans instead, and us kids cheered. Isn't that a great scene?
That's definitely Latino, the argument about food. Although I think over Thanksgiving, everybody's arguing at some point.
At some point.
At some point. That's like, that goes across cultures and races and everything. It's all about un pleito at some point.
At some point. Well, good luck with that, everyone.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks, Brenda, our social media diva, for pulling that all together for us.
Of course. And if you want to check it out, the Storify is on our website, so you can look at the other responses as well.
Okay. So is your tradition in Thanksgiving missing from our lineup? Speak up. Tweet at us. Our handle is LatinoUSA.
Si quieren saborear lo que yo traigo, les juro que no se arrepentirán. Traigo una receta exquisita que yo sé que le van a gustar.
So, after a big Thanksgiving meal,
I look forward to working it all off. And since our show this week is dedicated to aventuras, I decided to try something new. I'm going to run in my first ever race, a 5K in December. Some of our Latino USA producers are running it with me, and let me be honest, I'm a bit competitive. I don't just want to finish my first race. I'm looking for a bit of an edge. So we reached out to a Latina who knows firsthand that race day performance is much more mental than physical. Brenda Martinez is the first American woman to win a world championship medal in the 800 meters. She's the only Latina on the national track and field team, and she's a new world champion.
I used to be really bad when I was little, and I used to get hit with the belt. So that was my mom's form of discipline. And, you know, I actually appreciate it. My mom didn't know what to do, so one of her coworkers suggested, why not put her in club track? And, you know, she took me there first day of practice, and I haven't stopped since. Before my races, I think about the process and not so much the end result. You know, I try to go in there with a clear mind, so I try to do things to make me happy. So if that's watching my favorite movie, which is Pretty Woman, I'll watch it, you know, the day before the race or maybe even the day of. But once I go to the stadium, I know I have to think about the warm-up and then get through the warm-up, follow the same routine that I've been doing all year. And once I step on the line, then I have to focus on giving it up my all. For beginner runners, practical tips that I would suggest is being hydrated every day, refueling after the race as well. It's very important because you break your body after any training session, and having the right type of shoes, you got to find out how you have that foot strike on the ground. And don't change your diet the day before or anything like that. You know, people are known for getting food sickness right before a race because they changed something or they tried something new. So don't try anything new right before a race. And the last one would be just have fun. So my advice for Maria is try to have characteristics of being a headhunter. Towards the end of the race, just start picking off people and just have fun. And it's a grind. So just have fun and, you know, just bleed for whoever that's supporting you.
Our futuristas are running the Roosevelt Island Hot Chocolate 5K on December 15th. So encourage us in our training via Facebook or Twitter, and we'll let you know who made it to the finish line first. So I'm definitely pumped for my first ever race. But compared to some things people do in the great outdoors, I gotta admit, I've got a long ways to go. Mateo Sandate is a park ranger in a small town near Aspen, Colorado. The local population is about 30% Latino, but few come hiking.
On a regular day, we might interact with 50 to 100 people. A very few minority of those that come in are Latino.
But one woman is defying those statistics. Her five-word bio?
I would say high heels and hiking boots.
It wasn't long ago that Stella Juarez was overweight and depressed. But now, hiking is an addiction that's helped her to heal. She's on a mission to climb all 53 of Colorado's 14,000-foot peaks called 14ers. And she's inspiring others to follow in her tracks. Leslie McClurg joined Juarez and two young Latinas for a climb in central Colorado.
Wind whips across the icy parking lot at Mount Sherman's trailhead. Stella Juarez tells her two climbing partners to gather close.
We all summit together or we don't summit at all.
The forecast looks dicey.
Between 0 and 5 degree wind chill, gusts of up to 45 miles per hour.
The three women wrap their scarves tighter and strap micro spikes to their boots.
It's just basically a layer of steel chains with spikes in it. It's to give you extra traction in ice and snow.
Stella's climbing partners are Ariana Antonio and Diana Oregon. They're both 23 years old. They climbed their first 14er with Stella this past summer.
It felt so gratifying, and like I honestly, like, I wasn't sure if I was going to make it. And once I did, I was like, this was so worth it.
The most amazing feeling ever that I actually was able to accomplish such a big challenge that I had never done.
It's those memories that got them up at 4 a.m. today. The climb begins at about 12,000 feet. We gingerly pick our way across icy patches into the wind. The trail quickly transitions into rigorous switchbacks.
How are you doing? You're doing awesome.
Slick.
Yeah.
After an hour and a half, we're about halfway there.
We're starting to slow down. We've hit about 13,000 feet, and there's a pretty steep incline ahead of us.
The snow is about a foot deep, and that's hard on Ariana.
It's discouraging when you sink so deeply.
A little further up, we stop for a water break.
Oh my God, it's gorgeous. Everything's so white.
About an hour later, we're nearing the top. The next valley comes into view.
I love this moment, right when you gain the ridge and you look on the other side and there's just like this ocean of mountain peaks. It looks like ocean waves, except it's mountains.
But the moment is short-lived. We take cover from howling gusts behind an outcrop of rocks.
These winds are probably 55, 60 miles per hour.
We have a tough decision to make. The summit is within view, about 400 feet higher.
When we're up on that ridgeline there, we're going to be completely exposed. And you could see when we were coming right up that side, there's times when it blew so hard, it almost destabilizes you.
That is, the wind is so strong, it literally feels like we could be blown off the mountain.
So it's not really worth the risk.
Ariana hesitates.
I want to go. I really want to go.
But another gust confirms the verdict. We can hardly keep our feet underneath us. We decide to turn around.
That's icy. All right.
During the slippery slog back, Stella recounts the first time she went for a hike, just last year.
Literally at that time, I was so out of shape, I couldn't even handle the backpack.
Stella says her teenage son carried her gear. The trail was 2 miles long on flat ground, nothing compared to today. She was in the midst of a divorce and struggling with depression.
I just felt really frumpy and disempowered and sad.
But she was smiling at the end of their walk. Within weeks of the first hike, she set an aggressive goal to walk the Camino de Santiago, a 500-mile trek across northern Spain. Since then,
I just haven't been able to stop.
So she set her next goal, all of Colorado's 14,000-foot peaks. There are 53. She's checked off 20 so far, and she's lost 70 pounds. But she says her Latino friends and family don't understand her new passion.
There's like a cultural norm for what a Latina woman is supposed to be and do, raising children, being a wife. That's in some ways been a barrier to us in getting active into the outdoors, because this is something that's outside of that realm of what we're supposed to be doing.
She's setting out to change that, and so are younger women like Diana.
I think a lot of Latinas in my age group need to have that more open-mindedness and not be so constrained of our culture and our culture norms and what society tells us that we can and can't not do.
Stella says she hopes to knock out the rest of Colorado's highest peaks by the end of next year. The girls, meanwhile, plan to try snowboarding, a sport they've never done before. For Latino USA, I'm Leslie McClurg.
Coming up on Latino USA, through the jungles and down into the caves of Puerto Rico, stay with us, no se vayan.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, we're talking adventure. And one of the best moments of any adventure is when you can stop and laugh. So it seemed fitting that we'd hear from our two favorite funny guys on this week's episode. Here for their regular segment, we give you Al and Lalo.
Thank you very much, Maria. Today we are talking about what we are thankful for. Now that our Thanksgiving adventure has come to an end, I am thankful for quite a few things that I really maybe couldn't have brought up around the family. First of all, I'm thankful that my child's school mascot is the Falcons and not the Arabs.
The Arabs?
Yes.
And where would that school be in Beirut? Well,
no, Coachella Valley High School.
Really? That's not the Middle East.
No, it's not. This comes from Dan Bernstein. He is a writer in Riverside for the Press Enterprise. He writes that the school mascot logo depicts him the most unflattering caricature of an Arab.
Yeah.
He's got a scowl. He's got a beard.
He's got a waxy mustache coming out of his nostrils.
That's right. He looks like the Iron Sheik from wrestling. If anyone's a big old school wrestling fan, you maybe remember the Iron Sheik.
Yes.
That was pretty racist. Even the World Wrestling Federation has gotten better in terms of their characters.
Well, they're known for their sensitivity.
Yeah, exactly. But not Coachella Valley High School. The American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee wants the school to get rid of this logo, which has been around since the 50s. Now, that's a time where people aren't as sensitive,
right?
And that's a logo.
You know, when it is problematic when it's a group of people that you can point at, and I understand why the Redskins, obviously, are, you know, mascot is not cool. It's just not.
Look, there's a lot of decisions that were made in the 50s.
Yes. a lot of
and
bad
40s
ones.
And 30s that were not going to hold up.
Al, I am very thankful for a new adventure that I'm embarking on, which is a new full-time job.
You already have a full-time job.
I know. Being me is a full-time job for sure, but I'm actually overemployed.
You are overemployed. You have a lot of things that you're doing.
That's right. And
what's your new gig?
My new gig, thankfully, is writing and consulting spot on the new Fox television show Border Town, which is an animated cartoon coming out next year.
And who's making that?
The showrunner of Family Guy, Mark Henneman, executive produced also by Seth MacFarlane.
No, because when you hear that and you know you've watched some of the Family Guy, a lot of people come out like, hey
this is going to be
horrible for Latinos.
Yes.
Because it's going to be every single stereotype bundled into a show. And there's when you're dealing with jokes and your goal is to be funny.
Right.
Which that's what it is on the animated show and on the Daily Show even.
Yes.
Some people that have not grown up around Latinos may propose some bits that are not going to be culturally sensitive.
Right. In my opinion, falling into writing a stereotype as a substitute for a punchline, it's not good writing. It's lazy writing.
Story and jokes first, Latino second, and everything will be fine.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's why you're there. I mean, my dad loves raunchy comedy. He does.
Yeah.
He always will.
And Seth MacFarlane is tagged with that, rightly so. He's like a modern day Don Rickles, you know. And this is why I am there at that show, and also why the creator hired several other Latino writers. I think of having four writers, I just heard another one is being added. It's like a world record in there outside of a Telemundo show.
Because all the Latinos are now such a powerful voice that we're not going to tolerate somebody who's going to come on and do a bunch of, you know, horrible stereotype jokes. And that's what it can't be. That
that's right.
So if they better be thanking you every single day that you're there. I have something else I'm thankful for.
What are you thankful for?
I'm thankful for being a white Hispanic. does that sound familiar?
It does.
I guess I am a white Hispanic. I never thought of that until the George Zimmerman trial started happening.
He redefined, he put white Hispanics on the map.
Well, your buddy Jorge is back in the news again.
Yeah, now he's Jorge.
Now he's Jorge.
Oh, good old Jorge Zimmerman.
Jorge Zimmermano.
They're adding accents to it.
Yeah. Jorge is back in the news because he pulled a shotgun on his girlfriend. Zimmerman's arrest is the latest of several brushes he has had with the law following his acquittal in a case that drew worldwide attention as it sparked nationwide debates about race and self-defense laws. So when it was all about self-defense laws...
He was white.
He was white.
Emphasis on the white.
Well, it's a nice place to be as a white Hispanic, and that's why I'm thankful. Because, look, when it's convenient for you, when you're applying for college...
Yeah, I'll be white.
No, you want to be Latino.
Oh, sorry. I'm afraid neither would help me at this point.
Yeah, I'm screwed. So I need Latino. I really need him. But when you get pulled over by police, officer, you do your best black guy, white guy voice,
yeah,
and you're going to be okay. After the hearing, Zimmerman's public defenders said he did not appear to be suicidal and expressed confidence that he would be acquitted of any wrongdoing.
After he barricaded himself in his girlfriend's house.
Yeah, he doesn't appear to be in danger to himself or in danger to anyone else, said public defender Daniel Macaro.
Who has never watched the news.
Yeah. What? Another one of my favorite websites, Color Lines, did a great article. It was Julianne Hing. When the trial was going on, citing all the different times when he was Peruvian,
yeah,
and when he was white, and CNN got in a lot of trouble for calling him a white Hispanic.
Yeah.
So, Maria, the last thing we're thankful for is you. Thanks for having us on. I've been Al Madrigal.
I've been Lalo Alcaraz.
And we are the Latinos of the future.
And now... how about a little adventure underground? You've seen the glitzy ads with pictures of Puerto Rico's tropical beaches, and that may be it in terms of what you know about nature on the island of Puerto Rico. Maybe you've heard about El Yunque rainforest or the bioluminescent bay, where algae make the water glow when it's touched. But some of Puerto Rico's most impressive natural environments are actually located underground in an estimated 2,000 caves on the island. A few are easily reached by tourists, but to enter some of the more out-of-the-way caves, you have to enlist a seasoned caver, which is exactly what our producer, Marlon Bishop, did.
So, where are we?
I really don't know. We are in some place between Lares and Atillo.
John C. Carrion doesn't know where we are because we're lost in what could only be described as the middle of the jungle. We've been walking about 2 hours looking for a cave. We're doing this because John C. is a cuevero, a caver. And that means he must be a little bit crazy.
That's what people say when you say, oh, I was in a cave. People say, you're crazy because being inside a cave, people always thought that you would be in a close area without light, very, very far apart from civilization.
That's true, right? More or less?
Yeah, more or less that's true.
It's like you're in a close place far from civilization with no light.
That's true.
That's exactly what it is. Johnsy's not just any caver. He's one of the leaders of the Speleological Federation of Puerto Rico. So he's like a caving ninja slash superhero. At last count, he's explored 83 caves in Puerto Rico, at times rappelling hundreds of feet down into sinkholes and scuba diving through underground rivers. There is no funding for what he does and very little glory. Being a caver does not make you a chick magnet.
But it's something that you will have to experience at least one time.
A little while back, I emailed John C. out of the blue and asked if he could show me a cave with Taino pictographs, drawings made by indigenous Puerto Ricans before the Spanish conquest. Right away, he offered to take me out on an expedition with a few other spelunkers. The day started with us turning off a sunny mountain road and bouncing down a dirt path in Johnsy's truck.
Suddenly the road ends and we have to make some off-road.
When the vegetation gets too thick to drive, we get out and begin hacking our way through the forest with machetes, Indiana Jones style. But at some point we lose our way and we can't find the cave. It feels like we're walking around in circles for a very, very long time. Johnsy begins to look nervous. And then, suddenly, it's there, in front of us, this big hole. It's as if the mountain is opening its mouth wide and we're staring down into its belly. Vines dangle in front of the entrance. There's something surprisingly powerful about it, and even a little scary. If I were a dragon or some other kind of large, terrifying monster, I'd probably choose to live here.
This cave, as you see, is very far from civilization. So probably it's a place where the Boike or Taino shaman came to do what is called Cohoba ritual.
In a Cohoba ritual, the Taino shaman would fast for several days and then smoke the hallucinogenic seeds of the Cohobana tree.
And they get in this trance and they talk with spirit and gods.
Right away, near the entrance, we see the pictographs. They're high up on the ceiling, drawn with thick charcoal lines.
This one's maybe an alien face because the eyes are very long.
It's hard to say how old the drawings are. These specific ones have never been formally studied. In fact, few people have probably ever seen this cave, says Jonsi. Archaeologists have dated drawings elsewhere on the island as far back as 2000 BC. According to Taino myth, mankind was created in the caves, so the drawings are thought to have a religious meaning.
This look like a mouse. You can see it's like a triangular face with two big ears on the top.
After admiring the artwork, we gear up with helmets and headlamps and step into the darkness.
Just try to enjoy the cave, walk slow, watch all around you because each formation is unique.
Wow. I mean, we just walked into a chamber and just goes up and up. It's all these like amazing dripping rock formations kind of like coming out of everywhere.
The dripping water means that some of the stalactites and stalagmites in this cave are still growing. This is a process that happens on a totally different timescale than we're used to thinking about.
There is an estimate that a cubic inch takes as long as 500 years.
We're back in the world the Tainos would have been in 500 years ago, when the Spanish and the deadly diseases they carried first arrived on the island. So much has happened since then, outside the cave. But here inside, it's as if time has frozen. To continue, we get on our stomachs and crawl through a series of narrow, muddy passageways that connect into larger and larger caverns. Now, far from the cave's mouth, no natural light reaches us. We turn off our headlamps, and it's the darkest darkness I've ever seen. I try waving my hand in front of my face. Nope, nothing there. As far as I can tell, I have no hand.
Like, I understand why you would come here to do a ceremony. It looks like a place to talk to the gods, you know?
And in some caves, sometimes when you hit the rocks with your headlamps, you will see some shadows. And with a good imagination, you can see a lot of things in the walls of a cave.
In his own way, Jonsi also comes here to talk to the gods. If you listen to him talk about what draws him into caves week after week, it's kind of the same thing that made the Taino Bohiques want to come here.
Sometimes I have a lot of things in my mind. I just go into a cave and I turn off the light and just hear the silence. And that gives me some kind of relaxing, peaceful on my mind to reorganize some ideas. And being in contact with caves and nature give me that opportunity to be in contact also with myself.
We wind our way back to the cave's entrance, and we're back in the outside world, where time matters. It's late afternoon, and we hike out of the forest quickly to beat the sun down. We get into our cars and head back to our cities, where it's too loud to hear what the gods might have to tell us. For Latino USA, I'm Marlon Bishop in San Juan, Puerto Rico.
And now, a little wisdom, sabiduría, about a musical adventure. 80-year-old Alfredo González loved writing poems and had always dreamed of putting his words to music. But life got in the way, until now.
My name is Alfredo M. González. I am 80 years old, and I came to the United States in 1957. And since then, I've been here writing songs, poems, and raising my family. I was born in a small town in the state of Jalisco, Tuxcueca, Jalisco, Mexico. Every January 28, we celebrate the Fiestas Taurinas. Every day in the morning, they wake up the people with the music, and then with the clown marching through the streets of Tuxcueca. And every intersection, the clown recites his verses. I was inspired by the very simple words, but with beautiful rhyme. At the age of 24, when I came to Sacramento, I was working my regular hours, 40 or more hours, for 34 years. In the meantime, also, I start writing. I tried to work hard to see my kids be better up than I was. In the year 2005, I went back to Guadalajara, and I hired a mariachi, and they make music arrangements for my songs. It was beautiful. And I hope someday people will be able to listen to them. Later, until my kids say, come over, and they show me the article, and said, Dad, come to the computer, turn your computer on. I opened the page. Oh, but you should have seen my face, my eyes, the beating on my heart. It was a web page with tuxcuecamitierra.com, which is a description, like a small biography of what I am and what I have done, what my hopes are, trying to reach these songs to the audiences, to the radio listeners. That was the greatest surprise of my life. The greatest surprise of my life, because I never expect that. Yes, have your dreams. Persist, persist, and persist.
Soy de Tuxcueca, Jalisco. Es la tierra de mis padres. Su capilla en el cerrito. Empedradas son sus calles.
Words of wisdom from 80-year-old Alfredo González. And that's it for this week, mis queridos listeners. We'll see you again next time when we're talking about the politics of Latinos, Latinas, and sex. But for this week, Latino USA was produced by Carolina González, A.C. Valdez, Lita Hartman, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Daisy Rosario, Brenda Salinas, and Michael Jones. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our interns are Jonathan Wolf and Eva DeLapp. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Additional engineering this week by Brendan Baker. Special thanks to Rick Dulluck at KVCR in San Bernardino, California, and Alan Minsky at KPFK in Southern California. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa, and join us again next week. And in the meantime, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr, and check out my Instagram at Maria_La_Hinojosa. Hasta la próxima.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all, and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
Oh, what a cutie patootie.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Lumber Liquidators. Hardwood, bamboo, and cork flooring with the FloorFinder app for iPad and iPhone. Learn more at lumberliquidators.com. And the Lemelson Foundation, supporting inventors and invention to improve the lives in the U.S. and developing countries. On the web at lemelson.org. And the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives. On the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.